This is Radio Equalshock with your host, Alex Smith.
If space aliens examined this fossil-powered civilization, would they see a single organism? Are we something that consumes our home planet, converting it to dead waste? Can we change that? Dr. Eric Pinault is a professor in the Department of Sociology and the Institute of Environmental Sciences at the Université du Québec à Montréal. Over many years, Pinault compiled his book, The Social Ecology of Capital, published in 2023. It examines the metabolism of our current age. From Montreal, Canada, Eric Pinault, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
A well-informed listener recommended your book, which he connected to the degrowth movement, but actually, although you make a case of why growth continues almost forever under capitalism, degrowth is not really the theme of social ecology of capital, is it?
No, it isn't. It's something I take up at the end in the conclusion as kind of the political consequence of how I understand the materiality of current societies and their trajectory. But it's not a book about degrowth, even though I must say that it grew out of discussion with colleagues, mostly in Germany, in the German degrowth research community, but also colleagues in Barcelona.
Yes, we think of a metabolism as actions and reactions in an organism that sustain life. What do you mean by social metabolism?
Yeah, well, social metabolism is looking at society and trying to understand in an analog way, and I'll go further than the analogy in a few minutes, but in an analog way to a body or to a human being or to a cell, how societies must, to reproduce themselves in time, extract, transform, and then dissipate matter and energy. And this way of looking at societies is actually very old, and the first uses of the concept of metabolism in Germany in the 18th century, and beginning 19th by Liebig and others, they use the concept of metabolism not only to understand cells and human or animal bodies or plant bodies, but also to look at groups, cities, countries, societies. So it was a very plastic concept that then was narrowed down in the 19th century by biologists. And finally, since the, I'd say, mid-1980s, this more holistic understanding of metabolism has come back with people from what we call industrial ecology, so people that were looking back in the 60s and 70s and 80s at how our economy had to digest material, and basically that view was widened to the whole of society.
And just for orientation, what were some socio-metabolic systems before the emergence of fossil fuels?
We have, in the community that works on this is the community that we call ourselves social ecologists because we're interested in the ecological relations of societies. And we say there are two basic forms of relations. Societies have a metabolic relation, so they extract, absorb, transform, digest, and dissipate materials and energies. And societies also colonize ecosystems. They transform them. They cultivate them. They change. They can mineralize them, actually, also. So looking at, with these two tools, social ecologists will distinguish three large, and this is not surprising as a way to look at history, but three large metabolic regimes, we call them. Three ways of relating metabolically to nature, of extracting, transforming, and dissipating. Hunter-gatherers are one way of relating to ecosystems, and basically you're acting inside the ecosystem's relations as it is. You are affecting them like other animals and plants are affecting ecosystem relations. You are socializing, in a sense, the ecosystem, but you're still acting as a predator or as in the trophic chain. So you're basically taking biomass as it exists and using it. The second regime, which is the one in which what we call human civilizations arose, so literature, state, organized forms, political life, city life, urbanization, all this is tied to what we call the agrarian metabolic regime, which is tied to the Neolithic period and goes all the way up to the 19th century. And even today, there are still societies that are still relating in a predominantly agrarian way to ecosystems. And that's basically societies that depend on agricultural productivity for their material relations. And then finally, st- starting in the mid-19th century and then really coming together in the 20th century and still stuck in that today, and that's a problem for us, are the fossil-based societies. And we call it fossil industrial regime because industry tends to displace agriculture as the prominent relation to ecosystems, even though, and even further, agriculture is industrialized in a sense. So that's the way we cut out periods in history.
Until the modern industrial era, humans operated at the surface. And one of the things that really struck me reading your book and looking at your charts is that now the majority of our energy and materials come from below. We've become a kind of species almost like worms or moles that feeds on the underground.
Yeah, that was an observation that I took from an Austrian historian called Zifferle, Rolf Zifferle, who wrote a brilliant book called The Subterranean Forest. And his argument, which I take into my book, is that what happens in Great Britain during the Industrial Revolution is basically that that economy, that capitalist economy, is able to grow because it taps into energy that is below the surface of the earth. And if Great Britain had tried to pull off the Industrial Revolution only with its surface biomass, which is means, you know, what can we grow in our forests and fields, it would have been impossible. Growth would have stopped rather rapidly. So it was access to this pre-existing stock of biomass that was fossilized that permitted the Industrial Revolution to take off. And then from then on, we can say that that's our first takeoff phase where we become as capitalist societies, dependent on pre-existing organized matter that is under the earth. And then we turn to metals, and then we turn to stone, sand, limestone and sand, to bringing them together to make cement. And basically, we reconfigure our material relations from surface relations where we would depend on animal skins for our clothing or for our some tools. We would depend on wood. We would depend on what we can get from fields for ropes, for food, or what we can build houses or buildings out of would come from the surface, from ecological cycles. We would massively turn toward these geological materials. Now that's not to say that earlier in human history, we did not use these materials. We did look at the pyramids, but the scale of, you know, you calculate the amount of mass of a pyramid, and then you just look at a small town in the U.S., and you've got much more material of geological origin in these small towns. Let's say the one here that I live by, which is called Cowansville, you probably have about 10 pyramids in a small town. So it's really this reconfiguration of relations to the earth. And, you know, even though the concept of Anthropocene, which you might have talked about in the past, is being debated by geologists, we could say that we are or geological dependent species now in the 21st century.
And what is a metabolic rift, and does that apply to our current predicament?
Okay, so the metabolic rift. It's not actually a concept that I tend to use a lot in my work. It's a concept that comes from Marx, actually, and even before Marx, from Liebig. Now, Liebig is this German chemist who was interested in soil, considered one of the founders of soil science. He's the one that identifies these three critical minerals for plant growth, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. So we owe to him this understanding of the role of mineral elements in plant growth. And it was Liebig that talked about a metabolic rift when he said, well, we grow things in the countryside. And in the past, these things we would grow in the countryside would nourish the peasants, feed the peasants and their animals. And their animals and the peasants would then return this biomass back to the fields in the form of, well, manure, human manure or animal manure. And then we had a full cycle. So we had a metabolic cycle that worked, that was in balance. And Liebig says, with the advent of urbanization and of what we would call capitalist agriculture, so large-scale extractive agriculture, what we're doing is we're taking all this biomass out of the fields with the minerals in it. We're bringing it into the cities, concentrating it there, and then we're dissipating it in the cities. And usually that meant sending it into a river, into a bay, or into a lake or some water body. And the rift is at both ends of this linear process. So we had a circular process that was in equilibrium with nature. And this linear process, then the linearization of this process, implies a rift at both ends of the line. At the one end, you're depleting your soils because organic matter and critical minerals are not coming back into the fields. And at the other end, you're overcharging ecosystems, marine, river, or lake ecosystems, which have to absorb all this extra biomass supercharged with these critical minerals for living beings, which are nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. And then you'll get algal blooms, and you'll get basically what we would call today pollution. So Liebig is the first to look at this, and then Marx takes this concept and widens it and says this is something that is specific to capitalist agriculture in general. It is depleting on the one hand, and it is overcharging on the other hand. And this concept was then used, I think it really started to take off in the 70s and 80s as political economists that would refer to Marx would look at the environmental crisis as one where these circular equilibrium type relations are being replaced by linearized relations.
Talk to us about the late Murray Bookchin and his influence on your work.
Murray was a defining influence on me as a person, actually. I met Murray when I was, I think, around 19 years old. I went to study in Vermont, in Plainfield, Vermont, at the Institute of Social Ecology, where Bookchin taught. And I spent the summer there learning, and then we developed a very close relation. He was kind of my mentor. I was not a student at that point in my life. I was working, and it was before I entered university. But I was old enough to be in university. So Bookchin kind of replaced for 4 or 5 years what college does to kids when you're 20, 21, 22. So he had a really important impact on me. He really informed the way I understood society-nature relations and made me a radical environmentalist back in the early 90s, actually, and still to today. I mean, all my ecological activism really goes back to Bookchin. I started the book thinking a lot about Bookchin because Bookchin's philosophy is called social ecology. His theory is called social ecology. But actually, I had encountered another version of social ecology about 10 years ago when I was working on tar sands extraction in Canada and how to understand pipelines and things like that. I'm a political economist by training, and I needed something that could help me grasp the materiality of our society, of our economic relations. And I was looking around inside the field of ecological economics, and I stumbled upon this school of social ecology in Vienna, who are the ones that developed this metabolic understanding of economic relations. So I kind of adopted their approach. It seemed to me very fitting, very useful for critical analysis of fossil-based societies and fossil-based corporations, very analytically rigorous and well empirically grounded also. That's the thing I like about social ecology a la Vienna. It's very grounded empirically and measures, you know, quantifies actually the metabolic relations we have in a very rigorous way. So then I had to reconcile that social ecology with Murray's social ecology. And the one thing that I started reading once again, Ecology of Freedom, Philosophy of Social Ecology, and reading these works, well, first I realized how much he had an influence on me. But then also some passages or some ways of understanding the social nature relations sounded to me, or I read them as problematic from my point of view. Murray basically had an approach which was both analytical and normative. He was looking at ecology as a science to find some normative principles that then we could apply to societies. So, and he was using the ecology of his day, so the ecological sciences in the 70s. And then he found these principles like unity and diversity, complementarity, non-hierarchical relations, the importance of cooperation or symbiosis, we would say today, in ecological relations. And he said, well, if we look at these relations in nature, they are the ones that create a stable, flourishing ecosystem. So then, if we want stable, flourishing societies, we should mimic might not be the right term, but we should organize our social relations and our institutions around these founding principles. And for me, that was problematic because, well, first of all, ecological science has moved beyond the 70s. Some of these ideas have been conserved. Others have been subsumed by other ideas. That's one thing. And then as a sociologist, I had issues with the idea that we should transpose normative principles from nature to society. The second thing that I found problematic in Bookchin was his theory of history. And it's very subtle, and it actually, the problem I found was subtle because it's kind of a contradictory aspect of his argument, but one could find some form of evolutionism inside his worldview, where he said basically life the living planet has moved from simplicity to complexity and from very low degrees of reflexivity towards higher degrees of reflexivity and from low degrees of autonomy to high degrees of autonomy. And so this progressive or progressivist understanding of natural history, which then fuses with social history, for me was a problem. And I remember Murray would always tell me, Eric, don't read Stephen Jay Gould. It's total crap, and it's not, it doesn't work. And I read Stephen Jay Gould, and I really understood why Murray didn't like Stephen Jay Gould. Stephen Jay Gould basically considers evolutionary history as contingent. There are no trans-historical laws to the evolution of life on this planet. Life strives, flourishes, and collapses, and it's done so five times before the sixth time that we've forced nature into, which is the sixth extinction. But there's been five extinctions before the one that we've started, and so one cannot have this very linear understanding of nature, which again had a normative objective for Murray. So those are the two ideas that I basically had problems with. But the rest, you know, the importance of ecological relations for social relations, the autonomy, but the dialectical relation between nature and society in these relations, and the fact that the ecological crisis is grounded in social relations. That was the great argument that Murray made, and that is still today for me a fundamental idea.
So we've got many, many problems due to the growth of humanity and our impact on the planet. And when this is pointed out, business and politicians and labor and media all suggest that we need more growth in order to handle that. What is going on? Why is growth always the answer?
The growth is an answer because we are growth-based societies. And that's something that I discussed at the very end of the book. But I would say that, you know, my colleagues, especially, Jason Hickel or people like Yorgos Kallis or people like Matthias Schmelzer have written a lot about this. Or Anitra Nelson have written a lot about these ideas. And it's something that we can trace back to Schneeberg, actually, an American sociologist writing in the 70s and 80s. And he talks about growth coalitions. He says modern advanced capitalist societies are growth dependent, though they have divisions, though there are struggles between labor and capital, for example, or between the state and labor, or between the state and capital. These are the three great forces of capitalist society, three great macroeconomic agents of a society, labor, capital, and the state. So these three large agents, they struggle against each other. You know, they have their different material interests, but they all together have an interest in growth. They are all growth dependent. And actually, when they have growth, their conflicts tend to be mitigated by growth. So these distribution conflicts around who gets, you know, the share of output, of value added, of what comes out of our economy in the form of productivity or the surplus, we could call it. It's a concept that I use a lot in my book. This surplus, as it grows, then we're not, the social conflict around the appropriation of the surplus is mitigated. Whereas if growth stalls, if growth, then the struggle becomes very, very, existential for these agents, and societies tend to be riven by conflict. So this growth coalition, when faced with a crisis, will tend to look at growth as the solution, even if growth is the origin of the crisis. So that's an argument that, you know, that I make, but I think it's an argument, you know, going back to Schneeberg, an argument made by my degrowth colleagues. What I add maybe to this argument is more specific to capitalist economies. And I say that it's that when capitalist growth meets a limit, meets some form of resistance to its development, it will tend to accumulate more capacity at that point of resistance. And I'll give a real example in 2 seconds to overcome that specific limit. And a great example is oil. As we depleted our sources of conventional oil in the last 30 years. We're discovering less and less exploitable sources of conventional oil. You know, the old method where you would just basically stick a pipe in the ground and watch the black stuff gush out because you had access to these huge reserves under pressure. So as we run out of that, well, what we've done is we've accumulated capital exactly at that frontier, you know, the limit to extraction, and that took two forms. We've developed technologies around fracking, which gives us access to unconventional sources of oil in different forms of geological reservoirs that we knew exist. You know, we haven't discovered recently their existence. We knew this oil was there. We call it tide oil. We've known about this for almost 75 years. And then the other technology that we've developed is CCUS, where we go into these old reservoirs and we pump back CO2 or other gases or liquids, but mostly CO2, and we extract, we wring out the last drops of oil from those reserves. So that's, again, how growth is the answer to the crisis of growth.
Tracking the climate challenge, Radio EcoShock at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Eric Pignol from Montreal, and we're talking about social ecology. Now, Karl Marx, starting in the 1840s in Germany until he was expelled as a radical, he set out to capture the enigma of capitalism. What is it? And he analyzed world trade, and in great detail, one of the first real big picture operations of his time. You gathered an impressive catalog of charts and graphs not easily found in one place, so things like global material flows 1970 to 2017 and global primary energy consumption by source 1800 to 2020. Great stuff to find. Why did you go into those details?
Well, I needed to have a sound foundation to understand the material nature of our economy. I wanted to move away from impressionistic uses of the term of growth or accumulation. And I wanted to be confronted with the numbers. I think that there's something very important in being confronted with numbers, because you then discover things that you wouldn't have discovered otherwise. So first of all, that the biggest part of our material footprint is actually not oil, and it's not metals. It's basically cement. It's concrete. That's our biggest material footprint. And I wanted to confront the numbers, to have a picture, a representation of this materiality of the world economy, of the what I call in my book the throughput. So the throughput is the amount of matter and energy that is extracted and dissipated by society, of the way it's distributed among societies, around unequal relations between north and south and even inside societies. For me, that was an important aspect, to have this sound quantitative base of my analysis. I also made the gamble that today that tends to be the way societies understand themselves. So it's a language. For me, I talk about it at the beginning of the book as a language. It's a language that societies have developed because that materiality is today part of the problems that they have. Our environmental accounts have matured in the last 10 years, and I just happened to appear at the same time. And actually, since I've written the book, we now have up-to-date accounts for material flows to the year 223, and even estimations for 224, or 180 countries. So actually, I'm updating these numbers, and maybe I can throw one in just to give an idea of what it looks like when you work with this type of material. The amount of matter we extract globally is today, 223, around 102-101 gigatons of matter. And the estimations for 224 are 104 gigatons. When I wrote my book, we were actually 94 gigatons, I think I have in the book. So the growth rate is incredible. It's doubled since the 70s, this material extraction. And to put that number into perspective, if you look at the amount of biomass that nature produces in a year, everything that results from photosynthesis, what the trees are able to extract from the sun, or what the grasses are able to extract from the sun, which is basically the basic of all living relations on Earth. Well, that represents about 100 to 110, depending on how we count it, gigatons of matter. So today, human societies are extracting from the earth as much matter as nature, what we call nature, which is living nature, produces in a year. It's also very disturbing.
Yes, it is. And for example, you note that in 2015, that the total flow coming from food production was less than the total flow just coming from mine tailings. Now, that's pretty revealing about the kind of species that we've become. But that only works until the point of breakdown. Does your book include possibilities of collapse?
Actually, at the end of the book, I do talk about this question of radical transformation, either being a willful radical transformation or a imposed radical transformation from natural processes that would just go haywire. I don't directly discuss this question in the book. I have worked on it in other writings, in more scholarly writings, like a paper that I wrote with 30 other authors on planetary boundaries from a social science perspective or political economy perspective. So it's not something I take up in the book, but it's something I've discussed elsewhere. And the idea is that the way things could break down as we hit boundaries, of course, there are boundaries. So capital can transform boundaries into springboards. That's something that we observe through history. But this history we're observing is rare, from a Earth science perspective, is rather short. We're talking about 250 years, maybe, in terms of Earth science, or even in terms of material history of humanity, very short. You do have periods of what we would call today growth, of expansion, material expansion, but then you also have collapses, which are caused by climate-related events or caused by metabolic problems, like saturating soils with salt because you're over-irrigating crops, which happened in Sumer and happened many times in Mesopotamia. So then if you look back at our society today, then what is the time scale in which we're analyzing this problem? If we're looking at it in our lifetime, maybe we won't see collapse. We will see radical environmental change, and this will be very challenging for our societies. But maybe if we look at a more from a more secular point of view and go back and count in millennia, then, of course, our society will hit irreversible environmental change. And I'm a firm believer that this irreversible environmental change, nonlinear ecological processes that the Earth system science looks at, for example, collapse of, let's say, the Gulf Stream, that would be one radical collapse of the ice sheets, a total transformation of phosphorus and nitrogen cycles. We've taken them over because of our industrial agriculture. These types of things, which would bring around nonlinear change, which we would understand as human beings as collapse situations.
So, Andy, your last chapter is called Emancipation Amid the Ruins of Fossil Metabolism, and that says a lot about where we are. Eric, what are you working on next?
Usually when you look at economy, we look at an economy through the lens of two relations, production and consumption. And in my book, I argue that we should actually have a four-tier approach to economic relations, at least from a metabolic point of view. So we should look at extraction, production, consumption, and dissipation. And for me, extraction and dissipation are frontiers in the sense that they are system borders where nature and society interact around this frontier. And I'm working the working title is Accumulation Frontiers. I'm trying to understand how capitalism develops at the frontier, how it accumulation at the point of extraction and accumulation at the point of dissipation are important to understand the materiality of societies and also sources of ecological and environmental struggles and crises.
From the University of Quebec in Canada, we have been speaking with Professor Eric Pignol. He is the author of the big picture book, The Social Ecology of Capital. And this book gave my brain a hard workout, I will tell you. You can find links and more notes in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Eric, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Thanks a lot for having me. It was a real pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week.